hallway, John could hear muffled voices. Someone was telling the Prime Minister and then Ken Costello the news. He couldn't hear the words, but he could feel their effect. The shock of Mordecai's death was spreading through the ICU, as it would soon spread through the country and the world. A nurse pulled a sheet up over Mordecai's head while another filled out a clipboard of paperwork. They said nothing. They were professionals, and they were respectful of the dead. But John couldn't help wondering what they thought of Eliezer Mordecai. Could they ever believe what he'd believed? A moment later, Costello stepped into the room to pay his last respects. Then he gave both John and Aaron a quiet hug and stepped back into the hallway, making way for Prime Minister Daron, who came in next without his security detail. "He was a good man," Daron said after a long, awkward pause. "The best," said Bennett. "He had such certainty about life and such peace about dying," Daron observed, as he stared at the shrouded body of his friend of nearly 40 years. "I have to admit, I envied him." Bennett was surprised to hear Daron say it, but in his grief, at least for now, he couldn't find the words to respond. A Shin Bet agent popped her head into the room.
"Mr. Prime Minister," she said quietly.
"Yes."
"I'm afraid we need to clear this room for a few minutes."
"Yes, yes, of course," Daron said, noticing two orderlies waiting in the hallway, no doubt ready to take Mordecai's body to the morgue. With his arms still around her, Bennett led his grieving bride out of the room and followed Daron, Costello, and several aides and bodyguards down the hallway and out of the orderly's way.
"John, I know this is a very difficult time, but I wonder if I could speak with you for a moment," the Prime Minister whispered. "It's about Eli. I think it might shed some light on what happened."
Bennett hesitated, not wanting to leave Aaron alone, but she wiped away her tears with the handkerchief he'd given her and motioned for him to go.
"I'll be okay for a few minutes," she sniffled.
"You sure?"
he whispered back.
"Don't be long."
"I won't."
Bennett caught Costello's eye, and Costello immediately came over and guided Aaron to a lounge chair, sat her down, and offered to get her some hot tea, which she gratefully accepted. Daron, meanwhile, motioned to his chief of staff and press secretary.
"Would you both excuse us for a moment?"
The men took their leave, and with several security men in tow, the Prime Minister led Bennett to the stairwell and up to the roof. Mustafa al-Hassani needed some fresh air. He stepped out onto the balcony of his presidential palace, built by Saddam and now his very own, and felt the cool evening breezes coming off the desert as he listened to the steady drilling of construction crews and saw the great cranes in motion as far as the eye could see. A moment later, his consigliere, Khalid Tariq, joined him.
"You were right, Your Excellency," said Tariq. "They were more pliable than I had expected."
"You expected more resistance?" asked al-Hassani.
"I expected some resistance."
"Never underestimate the power of desperation, Khalid. Remember, these are men without homes, without hope, without the families and treasures they have always loved. They are adrift. They have no leaders, no direction, no sense of destiny. Like their great-great-grandfathers, they are once again nomads, wandering in the desert, and we are the shelter amid the storms."
"You were right about the temple as well," Tariq noted.
"Always remember," al-Hassani
said, lighting his pipe, his white robes rippling in the desert breezes.
"These men's faith in Islam may have shattered, but not their passion for Jerusalem. Jerusalem predates Islam. Indeed, it transcends Islam. Jerusalem has always been the temptress that draws men's souls. She is the jewel for which every ruler lusts. Men spilled their blood to possess her long before Muhammad was born, my friend. And with the right leadership, they will do so again. Our new alliance depends upon it."
"What if Operation Black Box fails?" asked Tariq.
"It cannot be allowed to fail, Khalid," al-Hassani said emphatically. "You must make sure of that. If we are to rebuild the empire of our fathers, we must stop the Jews, whatever it takes and whatever the cost. and we must do so carefully, without any of our actions ever being traced back to us. Did you tell me that pressure on Daron to build the temple is growing?
I'm afraid so, Your Excellency, Tariq replied. The Jerusalem Post has a new poll out just this morning. 78% of Israelis want to see construction begin on the temple within the next 6 months. That's up 9 points since the first of the year. What's more, Israel's chief rabbi is quoted as saying he wants the government to put up all the funds.
What more proof do you need? Asked Al-Hassani. It no longer matters how much pressure the White House puts on the Israelis, or whether the bureaucrats in Brussels stamp their feet, or whether the UN decides to pass a resolution warning Israel not to move forward. All of that is irrelevant. The simple fact is, if Daron refuses to build the temple, his government could very well collapse, which means we are running out of time, Khalid. We must stop the Jews from moving forward before it's too late.
Chapter 16. Tuesday, January 13th, 5:58 p.m., Jerusalem, Israel. The night air was damp and chilly. Bennett stepped onto the roof of the hospital and stared into the distance at the scorched surface of the Temple Mount. No matter how many times he'd seen the now barren sacred site, wiped clean, as it were, by the great firestorm, it was still surreal. The Dome of the Rock had been standing there day and night, rain or shine, since the 7th century A.D. The Al-Aqsa Mosque had been there in one form or another since early in the 8th century. Both had been modified, redesigned, and reconstructed several times over the years, to be sure, but they had been landmarks of history, emblems of culture, centers of learning and worship for Muslims nearly since the founding of Islam. Now they were no more. It was a fact the implications of which Bennett had not yet fully processed, given all else that had happened in the world and in his life.
"There is something you should know, Jonathan," the Prime Minister began, jarring Bennett back into the moment. "I know Aviza Doc shared with you several of the theories being bandied about in the press about who killed Eli and why, but there may be another explanation for why Eli died. Come, take a walk with me."
The concrete beneath their feet was wet from a late afternoon shower, and as they walked, they stepped carefully around the puddles.
"Last November," the Prime Minister began, "not long after the earthquake and the firestorm, I quietly asked Mordecai to come to my office. We talked about the Ezekiel option, about why he'd written it, and about what he thought was coming next. As you can imagine, he did his best to persuade me to become a follower of Jesus. He warned me time was running short, that the scriptures said, 'Now is the day of salvation,' and I asked him what he believed was next on the prophetic calendar."
"What did he say?" asked Bennett.
"He talked a lot about the rapture, which, if I understand correctly, is when all of the followers of Jesus around the world disappear in the blink of an eye and are caught up in heaven to be with God forever."
Bennett nodded.
"Well, he gave me quite an earful on that."
"And you didn't buy it?" asked Bennett.
"Please, Jonathan, I'm the Prime Minister of Israel, for crying out loud. Eli's prescience was uncanny, I will grant you that, but just because he was right about Russia and Iran doesn't prove ipso facto that Jesus is the Messiah. Believe me, I've read Ezekiel 38 and 39. They don't say anything about Jesus. They're not in the New Testament. They're Jewish prophecies written by a Hebrew prophet. While Eli loved to point out how many millions have become followers of Christ in the last few months, I would also remind him that we've also seen an unprecedented resurgence in Jews all over the world attending synagogue, buying Hebrew Bibles, wearing tefillin, enrolling their children in Hebrew school, and so on. The fact is, Jews are turning back to Judaism in record numbers, Jonathan. And why is that? Because they have seen the God of Israel, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, show himself in an amazing way."
"All true," Bennett conceded, "but I'm not sure I understand your point."
"My point," said Daron, "is that Christians and Jews have very different interpretations of what has just happened, and very different understandings of what is going to happen next.
But Eli did say there's at least one thing that all the Jewish and Christian prophets and teachers, ancient and modern, agree upon, and that is this. The next major prophetic event that will occur is the building of the third Jewish temple in Jerusalem. He pointed out that Ezekiel chapters 40 through 48 are all about the rebuilding of the temple, right after the war of Gog and Magog. And he warned me how explosive the issue of the temple would be. Specifically, he urged me to be on guard against a new evil that will rise and begin targeting anyone who tries to bring the temple to completion. He used that phrase, a new evil? Bennett asked. Yes, why? Asked Daron. Because he used that same phrase with Aaron and me just before he died. What do you mean? He said, but be on guard, my children, for a new evil is rising, more deadly than anything that has ever come before. Yes, yes, that's what he said to me, said Daron. And then, Bennett added, he told us to stop them before... Before what? I don't know. He passed away before he could explain. This may be all my fault, Daron said suddenly, almost in a whisper. Why? Asked Bennett. What do you mean? When Eli told me his theories about the temple and this new evil rising, I asked him to do one last mission for me, and now I fear it may have cost him his life. Bennett's stomach tightened. What kind of mission? He asked. Daron stopped and looked into Bennett's eyes, then turned away and leaned against the damp, cold metal railing along the edge of the roof. For a few moments he said nothing, just stared out over the twinkling lights of the old city, and it struck Bennett that the Prime Minister was measuring his response carefully. I asked Eli to do what he did best, Daron began. To think around corners, look over the horizon. I asked him to help me identify the forces behind this new evil and how they might try to hit us when construction began. Construction? Asked Bennett. Of what? Daron stared at him. The temple, of course. Bennett was stunned. You're actually going to let the Orthodox build the third temple? Of course not, said Daron. The government will take the lead. You're joking, said Bennett. But Daron shook his head. I've already pulled together a team of religious scholars, historians, archaeologists, architects, artists, engineers, everyone we'll need. It's all been hush-hush. They've all signed strict non-disclosure forms. I should have final blueprints on my desk by the end of next week. The funds are already set aside. They've been part of the military budget for years. And barring anything unforeseen, we'll start construction when the winter rains stop. Probably around March 1st. In more than 3 years of peace talks between the Israelis, the Palestinians, and the Arab world, Bennett had never heard anything like this. To the contrary, the Israeli government had always taken extraordinary measures to protect the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque from attack. They had long feared that any change in the status quo, especially an attack by an ultra-Orthodox Jewish extremist group, could unleash the wrath of a billion Muslims against the tiny state of Israel and instantly obliterate any hope of peace. And rightly so. Ariel Sharon had provoked 3 years of Palestinian riots and terrorist attacks just by taking a stroll across the Temple Mount in September of 2000. One could only imagine what a groundbreaking ceremony for a Jewish temple would unleash. Chapter 17. Tuesday, January 13th, 6:14 p.m., Jerusalem, Israel. Bennett couldn't believe what he was hearing. You're not going to let the Muslims rebuild their holy sites? He asked. What Muslims? Asked Daron. Eli said it himself. Islam is finished. Actually, Mr. Prime Minister, that's not what he said. He said Ezekiel's war would be the end of radical Islam as we know it. He was talking about the end of the jihadists, but there are still hundreds of millions of Muslims out there. They may be in a state of shock and disarray, but they still believe the Temple Mount is theirs. And this could be just the thing that unifies them and mobilizes them against you. Is that really what you want? What are you talking about? Asked Daron. I thought you and Eli were on the same page on all this. He was very clear.
After the war of Gog and Magog would come the building of the temple, and then the coming of the Messiah. Which means the sooner we get it done, the sooner we'll know who's right, you Christians or we Jews.
Look, said Bennett, Eli was the theologian, not me. I'm just telling you as a friend and a political ally that if you start building unilaterally, you're going to face international condemnation. You're not going to get a peace treaty with the Palestinians. You're not going to get a peace deal with Iraq or Syria or anyone else in the Arab world. Everything we've all worked for all these years will go up in flames.
I beg to differ, Jonathan, Daron replied, pacing around the roof again. Really, think about it. Who is going to stop us? All of our major enemies are gone. The world needs our oil. We're about to see the greatest era of peace and prosperity in the history of the Middle East. As soon as cleanup operations in Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria are completed, we will witness an unprecedented wave of tourism to the Holy Land, the likes of which no one has ever dreamed. We're already planning for it. New airports, new roads, new hotels, new theaters and convention centers, all financed by the petrodollars that are pouring in right now. The Third Temple will be the main attraction for Christians and Jews alike. For everyone, really, and that is just the beginning.
Meaning what? Asked John.
Meaning I don't want us to simply rebuild the temple. I want to fill it with the lost treasures from the First and Second Temple eras. I want pilgrims to come from all over the world and see ancient biblical history come alive right before their eyes. I want them to be able to see the past, touch it, experience it, and thus have hope for the future. That's why, immediately after the firestorm, I authorized funding for a team of the world's leading archaeologists and experts on the First and Second Temple periods. I asked them to search heaven and earth for the greatest Jewish treasures of the ages. I figured if Eli was right about even a small fraction of what he was saying, if we really are living in what the scriptures call last days, then anything's possible. Maybe the God of Israel is about to reveal that which has been hidden for centuries.
Bennett's head swam as he tried to make sense of all that Daron was telling him. But how is all this related to Dr. Mordecai's death? He asked.
Well, that's just it, Daron continued. About a month ago, I got an update from Mordecai and the team of archaeologists I'd put together. They told me they had new leads. The team seemed excited about the progress they were making. And then...
Daron paused. His shoulders seemed to slump a bit.
Then what? Asked Bennett. And then, one by one, the team started dying, starting with Lionel Mansfield, then George Murray, then Barry Jaspers, and now Eli himself.
Mansfield. The name surprised Bennett, but it registered instantly. Professor Lionel Mansfield was the famed British archaeologist from Oxford who had died in a mysterious car accident in London just a few weeks before. That was the story he'd been trying to remember when he heard about Murray's death in Washington.
You think their deaths are related? I'm absolutely sure of it, said Daron. They were all part of this clandestine archaeological team I put together, and now they're all dead.
What was Dr. Mordecai's take before he died?
We actually talked about the Mansfield and Murray deaths by phone while he was at your reception, Daron replied. He had no doubt the murders were related. He just couldn't figure out how anyone could have known both men were part of this team I'd assembled. There's been no publicity about the temple project or the team or anything. Not yet. Even now, only a handful of people know what we're up to.
Then you've got a leak, said Bennett.
Daron shook his head. That's what I said, but Eli said no. It's worse than that. It's not just a leak. People are dying. You've got a mole.
It didn't seem possible.
I personally selected each member of the team. Only a handful of my senior aides knew anything about it. But what else could it be? So I asked Eli to launch a mole hunt the minute he got back from Washington. And now look what's happened.
Was anyone else on this team of archaeologists? Asked Bennett.
Just one, said Daron. Yossi Barak,
over at the Israel Museum.
Did you say Barak?
Yes, do you know him? Asked Daron.
Break, Brock, broke. Could that be it? Yossi Barak?
I've never heard of him until just now, said Bennett. But just before Dr. Mordecai died, he was trying to tell me something. It was hard to hear him. At the time, I wasn't sure what he was saying, but that may have been it, Yossi Barak.
That would make sense, said Daron. They've been friends for years.
And who is he?
Yossi is the chief archaeologist at the Israel Museum. He's also the head of the archaeology department at Hebrew University and the world's leading expert on the Copper Scroll.
The what? Asked Bennett.
The Copper Scroll, Daron repeated. Eli never told you about it?
No. Why? What is it? The Prime Minister pulled out a pen and a small piece of paper, wrote down Barak's name and private phone numbers, and handed it to Bennett.
Call him. Tell him you need to see him immediately and that I said it's urgent. He'll know who you are and why you're coming. I'll have a car meet you downstairs.
Bennett wasn't sure how to respond. He was still in shock over his mentor's death. He had a grieving wife to care for, and he was supposed to be on his honeymoon. The last thing he needed to be doing was tracking down a serial killer. But Mordecai's dying request was that they find whoever was responsible and stop him before something far worse happened, and something told him he'd better move quickly. Chapter 18. Tuesday, January 13th, 7:32 p.m., Babylon, Iraq. Khalid Tariq poked his head into the darkened office. He expected to find Prime Minister al-Hassani reviewing his stack of briefing books for the upcoming visit of European Union Foreign Minister Salvador Lucente. The trip was shaping up to be a critical one. Lucente's aides were hinting that their boss was bringing a new proposal to discuss, but had no other details. And given that al-Hassani's own plans were likely to cause a great deal of anxiety in Brussels, they had to be ready. But al-Hassani was no longer sitting at his desk. Rather, he had settled into a rocking chair by a crackling fireplace surrounded by his beloved books. Among them were Churchill's The Gathering Storm, Gibbon's The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Tuckman's The Guns of August, and The United States of Europe, The New Superpower and the End of American Supremacy by former Washington Post reporter T.R. Reid, which al-Hassani had become fond of quoting of late. Each was dog-eared and on the verge of falling apart, having not just been read but thoroughly devoured by a man desperate to make up for the years Saddam Hussein and his thugs had stolen. Tonight, al-Hassani's head was buried in yet another 1,000-page tome of some kind, and while Tariq, from his vantage point, could not see the title, he could see the ubiquitous yellow highlighter in al-Hassani's left hand and the steaming cup of cardamom tea in his right. It was an all-too-rare moment of literary solace for a one-time professor, so long deprived in prison of the reading materials that had once been his life, and who was now once again increasingly deprived of the time with which to enjoy them. Tariq cleared his throat.
Forgive me, Your Excellency.
Al-Hassani motioned for his aide to enter, though he remained fixated on the book in his lap.
Khalid, how much do you know of the British monarchs?
Not much, I'm afraid.
Then you must read this when I am finished.
Did you know, for example, that at the funeral of England's King Edward VII in 1910, 9 of the kings and queens in attendance were actually related to him?
I did not.
It's true,
said al-Hassani, with a long dormant passion rising in his voice.
His son, George V, was the new king of England. One of his daughters was the Queen of Norway. His nephew, Wilhelm II, was the Kaiser of the rising German Empire. His nephew, Nicholas II, was the Tsar of Russia, and one of his nieces was the Tsarina of Russia. Another niece was the Queen of Spain, and yet another niece would soon become the Queen of Romania.
Al-Hassani looked up from his book and removed his reading glasses.
The secret of success is successors, Khalid. It is not enough merely to rule an empire. You must raise up future emperors who will expand and enlarge your borders long after you have rested with your fathers.
I concur, Your Excellency, but was it not shortly after King Edward's death that the sun began to set on the British Empire and on the whole of Europe?
It was, Khalid, said Al-Hassani. Mistakes we shall not revisit. To paraphrase Santayana, we must learn from history, particularly the history of Europe, lest we be doomed to repeat it.
Forgive me, Your Excellency, but I have Vigo Mariano on the line. I passed on your message, but he would still like to talk with you personally.
Is the call secure?
Al-Hassani asked instinctively.
It is, Your Excellency. We ran a trace. It's clean.
Where is he calling from?
Rome.
Very well, said Al-Hassani. He waved Tariq out of the room and waited for him to transfer the call. Vigo Mariano was a killer for hire. And to Mustafa Al-Hassani, the Sicilian would be worth every penny, $2 million up front, $3 million upon completion, and half the treasure if it was ever recovered, if he could actually deliver what he promised on time. The youngest son of one of the founding members of the Red Brigades that had struck fear in the hearts of Europeans throughout the 1970s and 1980s, Mariano, now 46, had cut his teeth in the world of international terror. Living in the shadows, off the grid, always on the offense, had simply become part of his DNA in his earliest years. If everything Al-Hassani had heard from friends and associates was true, no one in the underworld had a better track record of success. It was said that Mariano and his small team of associates had personally been involved in the assassinations of 23 of the 37 highest-profile CEOs and parliamentarians killed in Europe and the Middle East over the past decade. They were wanted by police in every country in Europe, and by different names in each country. Al-Hassani had first met Mariano as Bernardo Carlucci, operating under the cover of a cell phone dealer in Palermo. They had been introduced by Tariq on a trip to Sicily almost a year before. Mariano and Tariq had been roommates during their undergraduate studies in Milan, but few who knew them at the time would ever have imagined the partnership they had forged more than 25 years later, or the role they would play in Al-Hassani's rise to power.
I just heard from my team,
said Mariano when the call was patched through to the Iraqi president.
Mordecai is dead.
Good, said Al-Hassani. That makes four?
Correct. Operation Black Box is proceeding as planned and on schedule.
What about number five?
You should hear something tomorrow, Thursday at the latest.
And the other matters?
My team is working on the location of the treasure as we speak.
How much longer?
There are no guarantees,
said Mariano.
We still don't know for sure if it even exists, or if the information we have is accurate.
You assured me it was.
No, I said if it was accurate, we would find it.
Don't play games with me, Vigo. I don't have the luxury of time.
I'm not playing games, Your Excellency. I just want to be clear about our agreement. I cannot deliver what doesn't exist.
It exists all right. You told me yourself that Murray and Jaspers were sure of it. So was Mordecai.
Then perhaps we should have let them live a little longer, until they led us to it.
No, said Al-Hassani, his patience growing thin. We discussed that. It was too risky. We can't risk the treasure falling into the hands of the Jews. I cannot stress that enough.
Then with all due respect, Your Excellency, I am not sure what more I can do but update you on our progress as often as I can.
Push your men harder.
I cannot push them any harder than I already am.
Yes, you can, Vigo, Al-Hassani demanded, and you will.
Chapter 19. Tuesday, January 13th, 6:49 p.m., Jerusalem, Israel. Bennett found his wife resting in a lounge off the ICU. She was quiet now and eager to get back to the King David to rest and deal with everything that had just happened, and so was he. He thanked Costello for keeping an eye on her and promised to call him the next day. Then he briefed Aaron on his conversation with the Prime Minister, conceding that, for now, all he had were questions, not answers. Had Mordecai been killed for his faith or because of Daron's assignment? Who was Yossi Barak, another target?
A co-conspirator? What in the world was the Copper Scroll, and how did it relate to any of this?
So, what do you want to do? Asked Aaron when he'd laid it all out.
Take you back to Rhonda and pretend this never happened?
She tried to smile through weary eyes, and he took her in his arms. Every fiber of his being screamed, "Run!" He had already seen so much violence and so much evil, and the last thing he wanted to do was face any of it again. He had nearly lost Aaron to terrorists in Moscow, and neither of them could bear the thought of going through that again. Why couldn't they just live a quiet, peaceful life, with a house in the country, maybe have a few dogs to run with, kids they could take fishing and hiking in the mountains? He had never signed up for any of this. He'd been dragged into it by a president who'd betrayed him, and he wanted out, for good. Yet even now, months after his resignation, he still couldn't seem to break free. "But I have a hard time saying no to a man's dying request," he continued at last.
"Me too," she said. "I think we'd dishonor his memory and his sacrifice for us if we walked away now."
"So you think we should stay here?" Bennett asked, just to be sure. Aaron nodded slowly.
"I don't think we have a choice."
Bennett pulled her closer to him and silently thanked God for her. He didn't deserve this woman, but for the life of him, he couldn't imagine living without her. He pulled out his BlackBerry and the slip of paper Darone had given him and dialed Barak's private number. After three rings, a young woman picked up.
"Hello?"
Yeah, my name is John Bennett. I am looking for a Yossi Barak.
"Hi, Mr. Bennett. My name is Natasha. Dr. Barak is my grandfather. He just spoke to the Prime Minister. We were expecting your call. But let me say that I am so sorry for your loss. Dr. Mordecai was a dear friend of both of ours."
"That's very kind," said Bennett. "It's a hard moment for all of us."
"It is indeed,"
said the young woman. "And I'm sorry," Bennett added, eager to change the subject. "Is this Dr. Barak's home, or—"
No, this is his Hebrew University office at Mount Scopus."
"And you work there as well?"
"I do. I'm an associate professor of Near East archaeology. Normally there's a secretary here, but she's already gone home for the day. That's how you got me."
"So may I speak to your grandfather?"
"Actually, I'm afraid that's not possible right now."
"I don't understand," said Bennett. "I was under the impression that—"
"I realize the urgency, as does my grandfather, but he wanted to arrange some things before meeting with you. I explained all this to the Prime Minister. He understands. My grandfather and I can meet you and your wife tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. I hope that is acceptable under the circumstances."
Bennett wasn't sure what was going on, but he didn't have the emotional energy to argue. He and Aaron both needed rest and some time alone anyway. "Very well," he said. 10 o'clock tomorrow it is. Should we come to campus?"
"No,"
said Natasha.
"My grandfather would like to meet you in his private office at the Israel Museum. I understand you'll have a car and driver?"
"Yes," said Bennett. "The Prime Minister was very generous."
"Have the driver bring you to the entrance of the Shrine of the Book. I'll meet you there and guide you through security."
The phone startled Bennett awake. Rubbing the sleep out of his eyes, he checked his watch as the phone kept ringing. It was barely 4:30 in the morning. He grabbed the receiver and found Ken Costello on the other end.
"Sorry to wake you, John."
"Who died?" John said, without a trace of humor in his voice.
"No one. Not today,"
Costello replied. "Then why are you calling me so early?"
"It's Lucente."
Bennett's brain scrambled to catch up. EU Foreign Minister Salvador Lucente was set to arrive in Israel later this morning to tour the region with Costello and Prime Minister Daron. An exclusive in Yediat Aharonot, the leading Israeli daily, had reported the day before that Lucente was set to offer the Jewish state billions of euros in aid for continuing disaster relief efforts. It was the first such offer of its kind in the rocky history between the EU and Israel, and the country was buzzing. But so what? Thought John. What did that have to do with him? What about him? He asked, trying not to sound as upset as he felt for a wake-up call at such an hour.
"He's cutting his trip to Israel short to go to Babylon."
"What for?" Bennett whispered, trying not to wake Aaron.
I have no idea, said Costello. I was hoping you'd know.
I don't, Ken, and don't take this the wrong way, but what exactly does this have to do with me? I don't work for you guys anymore, remember?
I know, I'm sorry, but Lucente's chief of staff just called me from the plane. Lucente wants to meet with you and Aaron tonight, before he leaves for Babylon.
What are you talking about? Why?
He didn't say.
But you just said he's only here for the day.
That's right, he flies out around 9, but he'd like you to meet him for dinner.
Would you be there?
No, just you and Aaron.
Where?
Right there, at the King David. His advance team is already there, doing a security sweep.
And you don't have any idea what this is about? Bennett asked.
No.
Even off the record?
Sorry, my friend, but I need to get back to them with an answer right away. Apparently he'd rather have dinner with you than with Prime Minister Daron and his wife. That's who's on the schedule right now.
I'm out of the game, Ken. Do they know that?
Of course, but his people say it's urgent. He's up to something, John. He's angling for something, and I'm not sure what. But the President would like you to say yes and report back to him.
President McPherson knows about this?
Of course,
said Costello.
I called him before I called you.
Bennett sighed. What time does Lucente want to meet?
At 6 p.m., downstairs, at La Régence. You'll have the whole place to yourselves.
Bennett laid his head back on the pillow and closed his eyes. This was a mistake. He was getting sucked back into a job he'd just quit. But he told Costello yes, hung up the phone, and immediately hoped he wouldn't regret it. Mordecai's death was big news in Israel. Over breakfast, Aaron called Indira Rajiv back at CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, to check in while John scanned the morning papers. Rajiv offered her condolences. Aaron thanked her, but quickly moved on to the business at hand. You guys hearing anything on Dr. Mordecai's murder? She asked Rajiv.
Too much, actually,
said Rajiv to Aaron's surprise.
We're picking up chatter about Mordecai all over the world. It's going to take a while to sort through. He's certainly engendered strong feelings on both sides.
I guess so, Aaron said, stirring cream into her coffee. What are you thinking?
It's too early to say anything conclusive,
Rajiv replied.
But speaking purely on instinct, I'd say it was a team of Israelis, former special forces, probably religious, almost certainly with inside access to Israeli police and intel files.
Why do you say that? Asked Aaron.
Because the hit team clearly knew what flight Mordecai was on. They knew when he'd land, how he was getting home, and what route he'd be on. And they were waiting for him. That's not easy to do, not without help or access. I checked the El Al flight manifest myself. Mordecai wasn't even listed as a passenger.
He goes by an alias, said Aaron.
A man of his position would,
said Rajiv.
But somebody knew. They were watching him. What's more, they knew that he'd dropped his security detail.
A chill ran down Aaron's spine. So there was a mole inside Daron's team, and a team of assassins inside Israel's borders, and God only knew whom they might go after next. Chapter 20. Wednesday, January 14th, 8:17 a.m., Tel Aviv, Israel. The blue and gold Airbus A320 landed just after breakfast. With almost 100 members of the International Press Corps watching, the EU Foreign Minister's jumbo jet taxied across the runway at Ben-Gurion International to its designated tarmac, where Prime Minister David Daron and Special White House Envoy Ken Costello waited to greet Mr. Lucente as he came down the ramp. The three shook hands and smiled for the cameras. Then aides guided them to an Israeli military helicopter, and soon they were airborne and headed north toward the Lebanon border. 15 minutes later, they crossed a mountain ridge and began descending into a valley where some of the worst of the devastation from the firestorm had occurred. The scene so revolted Costello that he had to grab 2 airsickness bags, both of which were quickly filled. It was the first time he had seen any of the carnage in person. In an unprecedented show of tact, television networks back home had refused to show such gruesome images to Americans in their homes during the dinner hour. And though Costello had read all the intelligence reports and press accounts emanating from the region, neither the printed word nor dozens of still photos began to capture the magnitude of the disaster he now saw firsthand.
even all these weeks after the fact, tens of thousands of putrefying, nearly completely decomposed corpses lay strewn throughout the hills, alongside piles of bones scattered as far as the eye could see. Yet, even if one had wanted an unobstructed view of the carnage, it wasn't easy to get, given the swarm of vultures and rodents and dogs and animals of all kinds that had gathered to feast upon the bodies.
"Why has so little been done to clean all this up?"
Lucenti shouted over the roar of the chopper's rotors.
"This is actually a dramatic improvement,"
Derone responded over his headset.
"You should have been here the day after the firestorm. I've never seen such a horrific sight in my life. We have 3,000 soldiers working 16 hours a day, burying bodies and remains. At night, our Air Force sprays disinfectants, trying to keep disease from spreading. But it hasn't been easy, and our experts are worried the chemicals could soon contaminate our water supply."
They came up over another ridge and found a dozen IDF bulldozers pushing bodies into mass graves.
"I know it looks bad,"
Derone said before the question could be asked.
"But there is no time to dig individual graves, gentlemen. As you know, UN disaster teams started arriving a few weeks ago to help, but with the winter's rains, it's been hard to get all their heavy equipment in. And of course, every airport in Lebanon was destroyed, so everything has to come in through Israeli military bases near the border and be driven up here on trucks. It's very time-consuming, very labor-intensive, and very expensive. And very slow,"
Lucente added.
"How much longer until you're finished?" "It's hard to say,"
said Derone.
"Best guess?"
asked Lucente.
3 or 4 months, maybe more,"
said Derone.
"It all depends on how much the international community will help, and on whether the weather cooperates." "What is being done for the local populations?"
Lucente asked.
"Everything possible,"
Derone responded.
"As I stated in the report I sent to you, we've been airlifting in food, water, tents, clothing, electric generators, medical supplies, and as many doctors and nurses as we can spare. But the fact is, we're only scratching the surface. We simply don't have the money or the manpower to do more. That's why I wanted you both to see for yourselves what the situation is. These dead were enemies of ours, but they deserve the dignity of a proper burial. Yet that's impossible right now. And time is of the essence. Diseases like the avian flu are beginning to spread to the local communities. It's a miracle that a full-blown plague hasn't broken out yet. But it's a very real possibility, gentlemen. It could happen at any moment."
Words failed Costello. He had never witnessed anything so horrible, and all he could think of were the words of the Hebrew prophet Ezekiel, cited by Dr. Mordecai in his now infamous memo, describing not just a supernatural judgment of Israel's enemies, but its grisly aftermath. "As for you, son of man, thus says the Lord God, speak to every kind of bird and to every beast of the field. Assemble and come. Gather from every side to my sacrifice, which I am going to sacrifice for you as a great sacrifice on the mountains of Israel, that you may eat flesh and drink blood. You will eat the flesh of mighty men and drink the blood of the princes of the earth, as though they were rams, lambs, goats, and bulls, all of them fatlings of Bashan. So you will eat fat until you are glutted, and drink blood until you are drunk, from my sacrifice, which I have sacrificed for you." Was this not happening right in front of him? Weren't the birds of the air and the beasts of the fields gorging themselves on the flesh of the slain enemies of Israel, as they had been for months? Costello had never tried to memorize the words of Ezekiel, yet the words were now welling up from somewhere, and with them came a thought. How was it possible for someone writing 2,500 years ago to have predicted modern events with such eerie precision, unless there really was a God, unless it was, in fact, actually possible for man to know him and hear his voice and be guided by his words? Even for someone as irreligious as he, thought Costello, no other explanation seemed to fit. The Prime Minister's helicopter banked left. Soon they came up over another ridge, where more IDF bulldozers were digging more mass graves. Off in the distance, Salvador Lucente saw a huge convoy of several hundred flatbed trucks heading south toward Israel.
"Mr. Prime Minister,"
he asked,
"what are all those trucks over there?" "They're hauling abandoned Russian and Iranian and Turkish military equipment back to Israel, so none of it falls into enemy hands,"
Daron replied.
"Given all the pressing humanitarian needs, is that really a wise use of manpower right now?"
Lucente asked.
"With all due respect, Mr. Foreign Minister, we have no choice." "What are you talking about, David?"
Lucente countered.
"Israel hardly needs more weaponry. Your situation has changed quite dramatically. You have no more enemies. I would think now would be the time to dismantle some of your military, not add to it. Salvador, our forces have just captured 6,000 Russian missiles, each of which is armed with tactical nuclear warheads. Do you really think it wise for us to just leave those lying around on the battlefield unsecured?"
Chapter 21. Wednesday, January 14th, 10 a.m., Jerusalem, Israel. Natasha Barak met the Bennetts as scheduled. But she was not who Aaron had imagined. She was taller than most Israeli women, almost Aaron's own height of 5 feet 10 inches, with a slim, athletic build that suggested she spent quite a bit of time out of doors. She was also significantly more attractive than Aaron pictured most professors of archaeology to be. She was in her early 30s and had shoulder-length jet-black hair, warm brown eyes, a slender nose, and a healthy tan that didn't seem consistent with long hours cooped up in a museum. When they shook hands, Aaron noticed Natasha was not wearing a wedding ring. Natasha directed their driver to a VIP parking lot, then guided the Bennetts down a stone path and asked, "Have you ever seen the Shrine of the Book?" "I'm afraid not," Aaron said as she held John's hand. "Ever been to the rest of the museum?" "No, this is the first time for both of us." "My goodness, and you've been to Israel so many times," Natasha exclaimed. "I've followed your work with the peace process for years, not to mention your romance and your wedding, Mazel Tov." "Thank you," said Aaron softly, allowing the hint of a smile for the first time in 24 hours. "Yes, John and I have been to Israel many times, but always on business, I'm afraid, never for pleasure." "Well then," Natasha said as they approached the large white dome structure of the shrine and a set of stairs descending into a courtyard. "You're in for a treat. It's a Wednesday. The museum is not yet open to visitors. You'll have it all to yourselves." Aaron traded glances with her husband. "The Prime Minister asked us to come, so we have, but I'm afraid we're not here for a tour," John said as graciously as he could. "It's our understanding your grandfather may be able to shed some light on why Dr. Mordecai was killed. That's our only interest today." "Yes, of course, forgive me," Natasha said quickly. "I meant no disrespect. I know you have suffered a great loss." "No apology is needed," Aaron replied. "We understand you were both close to Dr. Mordecai as well." The young woman stopped abruptly, turned, and looked them both in the eye. "My parents were killed by terrorists when I was 7. My grandmother died of cancer when I was 9. I was raised by my grandfather and Uncle Eli. That's what I called him. He was my grandfather's best friend and mine. I can't believe he's really gone." There was a moment of awkward silence, and then Natasha turned and continued. Bennett looked around as they entered the shrine. "The building in which you are standing was opened on April 20th, 1965, Natasha said. "I wasn't born yet, but my grandfather was here for the big inaugural gala. He actually helped design it, along with 2 American Jewish architects, and they based it on an ancient interpretation of the War of Gog and Magog."
"Really?" said Bennett, suddenly intrigued. "How so?"
"Well, you see, the Shrine of the Book is similar, in a sense, to your National Archives building in Washington," Natasha explained. "It protects and displays some of Israel's most important founding documents, namely the Dead Sea Scrolls. Most of the scrolls were written by a Jewish sect called the Essenes, who lived near the Dead Sea around 200 BCE. Now, what's interesting about the Essenes
is that they were convinced that the war of Gog and Magog was imminent. They saw themselves as the sons of light, squaring off against the sons of darkness, and they believed that as soon as the war was over, a new temple would be erected and the Messiah would come. So when the architects were looking for a theme for this building, my grandfather suggested this war between good and evil, this war of Gog and Magog. The dome we saw outside symbolizes the lids of the jars in which some of the scrolls were found, and it is painted white to represent the sons of light. That large wall you saw upstairs, the one directly opposite the dome, is black to represent the sons of darkness, to convey the spiritual tension between the two warring camps. Natasha led them down the dark, cavernous hallway to the main exhibits. The air was cool and dry. An ever so slight breeze was coming from a state-of-the-art air conditioning and dehumidification system, and the farther they went, the more intrigued Bennett became. In one display were the actual clay jars in which several of the scrolls had been found, and sure enough, the lids looked exactly like the curvaceous dome they had just seen. In another display were small, ink-stained quills, the very ones used by the Essenes to write the scrolls so many centuries ago. And then they entered the main exhibit hall, a circular room, directly underneath the great dome, in the center of which was a large drum-like glass display case, lit from within, and designed in part, it seemed, to look like the end of a scroll handle. Bennett let go of his wife's hand for a moment and bounded up the 6 steps leading to the curious display. He was stunned by what he found. Inside the case, unfurled and carefully mounted on a large internal drum, was a 9-foot portion of the Isaiah scroll. Like a kid outside of Macy's at Christmas, Bennett pressed his face against the glass to see it for himself. "You are looking at the oldest Bible manuscript ever found," Natasha said reverently, almost in a whisper. "Written at least 2 centuries before the birth of Christ, it's at least 1,000 years older than any previously known copy of the Book of Isaiah." "And this is the real thing?" asked Aaron. "We usually put a replica on display for security," Natasha replied, "but we knew you were coming, so we bent the rules a bit. Yes, that's the real thing." "That's incredible," said Bennett, peering through the glass at parchment so incredibly well preserved. Here was a scroll penned 200 years before the birth, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Yet it contained the words of the very Hebrew prophet who had said the Messiah would be born of a virgin, live in Galilee, be a light to the nations, suffer and die for the sins of mankind, and yet rise again, and prolong his days, and the good pleasure of the Lord will prosper. And Bennett was less than 2 inches away from it. He could scarcely take it in. Natasha then led them over to a smaller display case, to one side of the rotunda. "This one is called the War Scroll, laying out the Essenes' vision of the War of Gog and Magog." She translated a passage from the ancient Hebrew. "Thou hast revealed to us the times of the battles of thy hands, that thou mayest glorify thyself in our enemies by leveling the hordes. Make for thyself an everlasting name among the people. When thou chastisest Gog and all his assembly gathered about him, for thou wilt fight them from heaven." "And that's not all," said Natasha. "Follow me." Now she led them to another case, in which a white card mounted in the corner said, 4Q285, Fragment 4, from the Rule of War. Again, Natasha translated from the Hebrew. "Wickedness will be smitten, the prince of the congregation and all Israel, which was written in the book of Ezekiel the prophet, I will strike your bow from your left hand, and make your arrows drop from your right hand. On the mountains of Israel you will fall." "Sound familiar?" Natasha asked. It certainly did, Bennett realized. The words had been seared into his memory in the weeks leading up to their fulfillment. "Ezekiel, chapter 39, verse 3, and part of verse 4, he said in amazement. "Did Dr. Mordecai know these were here?" "Absolutely," said Natasha. "These aren't usually the scrolls and fragments we have on display, but when Uncle Eli published his Ezekiel option memo on the web, my grandfather called him and invited him over to see these. They've been here ever since."
They were on display when the firestorm happened? Aaron asked. They were, Natasha confirmed. My grandfather believed Ezekiel's prophecy was about to come true, and that the war of Gog and Magog would trigger the coming of the Messiah. He and Uncle Eli only disagreed about which coming that would be, the first or the second.
How about you? Bennett asked. What do you think? But they were interrupted by a door they hadn't even seen opening behind them, and there stood Natasha's grandfather, motioning them to follow.
Chapter 22. Wednesday, January 14th, 10:29 a.m., Jerusalem, Israel. Now in his 80s, Yossi Barak still had a young man's zeal. He wore a small yarmulke, or kippah, atop a shock of silver hair. He had a neatly trimmed salt-and-pepper beard. His wrinkled, wizened face betrayed a lifetime of struggle in a land that had seldom known peace. Standing there in baggy trousers and a slightly frayed blue Oxford button-down shirt covered by a brown cardigan sweater, he was a bit stooped, and he steadied himself on a beautifully carved wooden cane. But it was his green eyes, shining full of passion and curiosity, even behind gold-rimmed spectacles, that drew Bennett's interest.
"Come, follow me," Dr. Barak said in a thick, gravelly voice that suggested a pipe or cigar was rarely far from his side.
Natasha waved them forward, and together they slipped out of the shrine's main exhibit hall, through the doorway, and down a dim hallway to a cluster of small offices attached to a conference room and a lab of some kind, marked with signs that read "Authorized Personnel Only" in English and Hebrew. A moment later, the foursome entered a wood-paneled conference room, and Dr. Barak directed them all to take a seat in any of the dozen leather executive chairs that surrounded the large rectangular mahogany table.
"Coffee, anyone?"
he asked, already pouring himself a mug at a drink station at the far end of the room. Both Bennetts accepted the offer. Natasha asked for water. Barak fixed the drinks and then joined them at the table.
"It is so good to finally meet you both," he said after taking a moment to catch his breath and wipe his forehead with a clean handkerchief he kept in his trouser pocket. "Eli spoke so much about you. I feel like you're practically my own grandchildren. I suspect, however, he told you little, if anything, about me."
"I'm afraid not," Bennett said, though he'd been racking his brain for the past few minutes trying to think of any reference Mordecai might have made to him or Natasha.
"He was a man of his word," Barak sighed, "a real class act."
"I'm afraid I don't understand," said Aaron.
"Well, we've been friends for almost 50 years, the old man explained. "We served in military intelligence together. We served in the reserves together. Our wives, God rest their souls, were close when they were alive. We even vacationed together once. But when he became, how do you say it, born again, I'm afraid we had a falling out. We didn't speak for several years, and when we did, when we tried to patch things up between us and get together from time to time, I asked him not to mention it to anyone."
"Why not?" asked Bennett.
"Well, you must understand that I come from a very strict religious community, and to them, any time I spent with Eliezer Mordecai was fraternizing with the enemy. But God bless him, he was a man of his word even to the end. He said he wouldn't tell anyone about our friendship, and he didn't. I'm really going to miss him."
Barak took a deep breath, dabbed his eyes with his handkerchief, and shifted gears, just as Natasha had a while earlier.
"So, you are probably wondering," he said, staring into his coffee, "what brought us back together?"
The Bennetts nodded, but he didn't see them. Not that it would have mattered. It was obvious he was going to tell the story anyway.
"A treasure hunt,"
Barak said softly. "I'm afraid I don't follow," said Bennett.
"Well, it's like this. After so many years of not speaking, Eli just called me out of the blue one day and said he'd found a clue, a big clue, to a puzzle I'd been trying to solve for decades. And then he made me an offer I couldn't refuse. If I would talk to him again, he would help find the greatest treasure the world has ever known."
The old man had their full attention now, Natasha's too,
though Bennett was sure she had heard this story 1,000 times before.
"Is everything ready?"
Barak then asked, turning to his granddaughter.
"Whenever you are," Natasha replied.
"Very well, then," said Barak. "What are we waiting for? Let's go."
"Go where?" asked Bennett.
"Let's go for a little ride."
5 minutes later, they were on the museum's roof, boarding a helicopter, donning headphones, lifting off, Natasha at the controls, Barak playing co-pilot, and banking eastward into the sun, though John and Aaron had no idea where. Out of the left rear window, Bennett could see the Israeli Knesset building, not far from the museum grounds. Soon they were flying over the Temple Mount and the Mount of Olives before making a slight correction to the south.
"Dr. Barak, do you mind letting us in on our destination?"
John asked, adjusting the volume of his headset and trying to hear over the roar of the rotors.
"What, and spoil all the fun?"
asked Barak, clearly enjoying himself.
"Let me guess,"
said Aaron.
"Qumran, where the scrolls were found."
"Good try,"
Barak replied, his eyes still fixed on the horizon ahead.
"But not even close."
"Masada?"
asked John.
"What for?"
said Barak.
"Great place to visit, but irrelevant to the treasure hunt I'm taking you on."
"Then where?"
Aaron pressed. Barak mumbled something in Hebrew they couldn't understand, and then, when he seemed confident Natasha had the flight under control, he turned back as best he could to address them both face to face.
"It will all make sense in a moment,"
he insisted.
"But first, I must tell you a little story, okay?"
They hardly had a choice, so they leaned back, enjoyed the flight and the view, and let the old man tell his tale.
"The year is 1947,
Barak began.
"The Nazis have been defeated. Europe has been liberated. The concentration camps have been shut down. The British are preparing to pull out of Palestine. The UN is carving up the Holy Land between the Arabs and the Jews. We Jews are about to declare our independence, and 5 Arab nations are preparing to attack us and wipe us off the face of the earth. Meanwhile, a few miles east of Jerusalem, 2 shepherds, Bedouins actually, begin tossing stones into a distant mountain cave. Suddenly, they hear something shatter, like pottery or glass. Their first thought, buried treasure. So they return at night with friends, ropes, torches, and plan to scale the sheer rock face and enter the remote cavern. They're electrified by the hope that what is waiting for them is gold or silver or precious jewels. To their dismay, that's not what they find. But in time it will become clear that what they have stumbled upon is a treasure much greater by far. The Dead Sea Scrolls."
Barak stopped for a moment, fished several bottles of water out of a cooler, offered 2 to the Bennetts, and then took a swig of his own. A moment later, he was back to his story, his voice low and mysterious.
"Over the next few years, more than 800 scrolls and more than 100,000 fragments were discovered,"
he explained.
"Whole books of the Bible, such as the Isaiah scroll Natasha showed you, emerged from the caves of Qumran. Sections of nearly every Old Testament book were found, along with religious commentaries and detailed descriptions of the day-to-day lives of religious Jews under Roman occupation."
He stopped abruptly and pointed out the window off to their right.
"We're flying through the Jordan Valley,"
he explained.
"That's the Dead Sea down there. Can you see it?"
"Yes,"
they said.
"Good. Now look over there to the west,"
Barak instructed as he urged Natasha to bank a bit so John and Aaron could get a good look. All Bennett could see were mountains, dusty, barren, and bleak.
"Now, you see those foothills, those caves?"
Barak asked. They did.
"Well, that, my friends, is Qumran. That's where the scrolls were found, where history was made."
"Wow,"
said Aaron.
"You'd never suspect something important would be hidden away in something so nondescript."
"That's so often the case with archaeology,"
said Barak.
"Where you least expect it, expect it."
Aaron pointed at a cluster of buildings on a parking lot.
"What's that?"
she asked.
That's the visitor center and the offices that run the excavations at Qumran.
They're still digging there?
A bit, yes,
said Barak.
Plus, there's a little theater and museum there, a gift shop, a snack bar, some restrooms, that kind of thing. And that's where we're headed?
Asked Bennett.
No, no,
said Barak, pointing eastward.
Qumran was a big story in its day, the biggest archaeological discovery in history to that point. But believe me, Jonathan, based on the research Eli and I did, I can tell you, it pales in comparison with what is coming next.
Chapter 23. Wednesday, January 14th, noon, Jerusalem, Israel. The Prime Minister's helicopter landed on the Temple Mount. Surrounded by their protective detail,